Revelations from the Battlefield.
Part 2.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq war diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers? Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
What the Army found after looking at thousands and thousands of deployments is that repeated deployments push you down the spectrum towards negative outcomes. Does that mean that if I went to Iraq for 12 months, I would come back a murderer? No, it doesn't. But does that mean that someone who might have been married and never had a problem with alcohol might get divorced and have a problem with alcohol, or might get arrested for assault or something like that? Yes. And can some people get shoved even farther down the line, or start farther down the line and get shoved even more? A lot of these guys that I wrote about are kids who didn't do that well in high school. They saw the Army as an opportunity because their other opportunities had been shut off. And they were good at what they were doing. A number of them said to me, you've got to be a little crazy to be in the infantry. And a lot of times the crazy guys are the ones who do the best in Iraq. But when they come back, they are already set up pretty low on the negative outcome spectrum. And when they start dealing with depression, PTSD, substance abuse, it's game over.
Kenneth Eastridge was open with Army recruiters about his criminal history, including a homicide charge as a juvenile. Several recruiters turned him away. But with enough persistence, Eastridge was able to convince one recruiter to enlist him despite his record of violence.
A lot of them were just kicked out of the Army for being bad soldiers because they were melting down emotionally. And once they were kicked out, they were sort of cut loose and had nowhere to go. They started drinking. They were carrying weapons all the time because they were extremely paranoid. They started using a lot of drugs. you put those things together with the training of an infantry soldier, and it's not long before somebody gets killed.
Courtney Lockhart enlisted in the Army after high school as a computer operator, but was deployed to Iraq as a foot soldier. Like many soldiers, he did not want to go to Iraq. His traumatic experiences in Iraq, including regular roadside bomb attacks on his brigade and the deaths of close friends, haunted Courtney upon his return from deployment. Like many of the soldiers in his unit, Courtney showed many of the signs of post-traumatic stress. He began smoking marijuana to calm his nerves from nightmares and paranoia, and was discharged from the military for marijuana use and violence, but was never screened for mental illness. In 2008, Courtney Lockhart abducted an 18-year-old girl from her college dorm, robbed and attempted to rape her before killing her with a handgun. Lockhart confessed and was convicted of the murder. The jury in his case recommended life imprisonment without parole, but the judge sentenced Lockhart to death by lethal injection.
I mean, one of the things that we've learned is it's not, and the military has learned over the number of decades, it's not so easy to get people to kill. Until relatively recently, the majority of soldiers in combat never fired their weapons. Since World War II, this has become a major preoccupation of the military.
Surveys of American soldiers who served in World War II showed that only 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons, even when ordered to do so.
For most of us, it's very, very hard to shoot to kill somebody. So the military goes through great effort to teach soldiers to become killers, to desensitize them. And that's what basic training is about. There's all kinds of chants that are rather horrific about killing people because it's very hard. You have to get these people to not think about people that they're killing people.
As a result of these findings, the U.S. military intensified its training and conditioning of soldiers to fire at and kill the enemy. Some soldiers report they find it difficult to switch off this aggressive, vigilant mentality when they return home.
If a soldier reports mental illness or problems that they're having, that can have an impact on their career. I mean, if let's say an officer goes in and tells a superior that I'm feeling a little off today. I think I might be losing it. I'm having a difficulty, you know, maintaining a touch with reality. Well, are you going to give that officer a job that requires him to handle weapons, to handle increased responsibilities? Are you going to promote that officer? You're not. It's going to be career damaging to self-report that. And that's where I think you see a lot of increased rates of suicide, of alcoholism, and a lot of these other acting out scenarios that we've seen from soldiers who have returned after facing those kinds of stress.
You come back and you're supposed to fit into civilian society. You know, either people want to ask, what's it like being in war? And you don't want to talk, or they don't want to hear about it. They want you to come back and, you know, hug the kids, love the wife, and you're just not quite there, and you don't feel you fit in. And so it can magnify things because you've left this whole life. You're trying to return to it, but you're not quite there for many of them. And then you've got the whole set of experiences. You've got the fact that you're on alert all the time. You know, a car backfires, and it's like you're back on the streets of Basra. And it's just very, very hard for a lot of people to live with this.
One of the things that shocked me about learning about these crimes, about you know, maybe a dozen soldiers all getting arrested for senseless shootings, basically, is how easy it is. It seems like a long way to go from being a law-abiding, normal person to a murderer, but really it isn't. Okay, these are guys who have extensive weapons training. They know how to not only use a weapon, but at least all the ones I'd spoken to had killed people in Iraq. One of the guys had killed over 60 people.
In the wars that we've had recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have, as you do in counterinsurgency type situations, you have an enemy who can't be distinguished from the civilian population. You don't know who's your enemy. So you're on a constant alert. You're fearing people on a daily basis. You're sometimes killing people without being completely certain as to who they were, because that's the nature of these types of actions.
Now, take a young man with that kind of training, that kind of experience. Bring him home. Give him lots of alcohol, because that's what they did to medicate themselves. Give them some drugs. They were looking for the high of combat, and a lot of times they replaced it with crystal meth, cocaine. Give them a loaded weapon that they carry at all times. And that's what these guys did. For some reason, they didn't feel safe when they came home. And the thing that made them feel safe was carrying a loaded weapon, and they all did it. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of people in Colorado Springs right now who are doing it. Now, you combine all those things and add a little stress, a fight with somebody, someone cutting you off, a bad day. And it's very easy to kill somebody. And then you've crossed the line, and it's a very thin line between thinking it and doing it and having done it.
John Turner served as a Marine infantryman in Iraq, including tours in Fallujah and Ramadi. Since returning from war, he has become a peace activist and a vocal advocate for healing of soldiers' mental wounds.
You know, it's so easy to send somebody off to do dirty work, but come home and there's nothing, man. There's no purification, right? There's no ceremony to welcome you back to being home. And it's a shame. And it took me a long time to realize that I was home. You know, I've been back for 6 years, almost 6 years now. And I've still never had a proper welcoming ceremony.
A lot of the guys that I've talked to said that they wished there was something more sort of structured and removed from society that was sort of a halfway house in between combat and home. You know, they feel, especially guys that go back and forth every couple of years, are just yo-yoed between two worlds and find that they belong in neither.
It's a very hard thing to do, because even when they try and set up programs, they have it on the ships coming back, and there was a period where they put people on ships rather than airplanes to give them a period of decompression. But all the soldiers want to do is get home to their families. And, you know, so even if you set up programs, they don't want to be thinking about it. And it's a very hard task. You don't just turn on a killer and then turn them off.
All of a sudden, you're in theater and you're being blown up. And then 2 days later, you're looking at your family on, you know, in the green. It's a wild experience. And you don't care, because all you want to do is get home. That's all that matters, is getting home. But what is so important is that time in between there to talk the stories over with your friends, with your buddies that you were in those experiences with. And that's got to be one of the hardest transitions in the world, you know?
The story, I think, touched me more than any others in these interviews was the story of a guy named John Needham. He was a kid from California. Actually, he was a professional surfer before he joined the Army. And he joined the Army pretty late in 2004, when it was clear that the Iraq War was going pretty badly. And he thought to himself, well, here it is. Here's a time when my country actually needs me, and I'll sign up. And by all accounts, he was the best soldier in his platoon, the right hand of the lieutenant, big, strong, smart, good-looking. Everyone liked him. According to him, on their tour in Baghdad, his platoon went dark. They started doing things that he thought were unnecessary. They started, for example, mutilating dead bodies and putting them on their Humvee and then driving around the neighborhood, which they suspected was full of insurgents, and they were probably right, and saying, "You're next." They started killing people that he thought didn't deserve to be killed. A kid on a bicycle, a guy walking down the street, and they would cover it up. And he didn't want to do that, and he turned against his platoon, and they turned against him, and he felt trapped in this position where he didn't know there was no way out. It eventually drove him crazy, and he tried to shoot somebody in his platoon. After that happened, they sent him back to Fort Carson, because the model of that battalion was, if someone starts acting crazy and they're too dangerous to be in Baghdad, send them back to Colorado Springs. That's obviously a very dangerous solution for everybody. He got back to Colorado Springs, and they told him they were going to court-martial him for trying to shoot someone in his platoon, someone he believed was doing something very illegal. Fortunately, his father, who is a well-educated, retired Army officer, intelligence officer, intervened and said, "Look, this kid doesn't need to be punished. He needs help." And so they got him into treatment for PTSD, but it wasn't effective. It wasn't effective, and his father finally brought him home after he retired from the Army. He couldn't hold a job. He just stayed inside all day, and he would have these flashbacks, usually during the middle of the night, where he would take off all his clothes and think he was back in Iraq, and he would hide behind furniture, thinking that there were insurgents everywhere. You know, his father didn't know what to do. He tried to get him committed to the VA hospital because he needed inpatient care, but there was no room, and he didn't qualify. And eventually, John Needham beat his girlfriend to death. He was arrested. He got out on bail, miraculously. His father put up, I think, about $200,000 in bail. And he later died under very uncertain circumstances of a drug overdose, whether it was intentional or accidental. But he was a guy who was so together, was such a sort of a someone who had everything, who was just totally undone by his experience until he had nothing left. And I think about him all the time and how it could have been really different for him.
Everything that I've gone through, everything that my friends have gone through, I've forgiven. You know, and it's just, I can keep saying that word, and hopefully it has set in somewhere in every person, you know, forgive, 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 and learn. It doesn't matter what someone did to you, it's not going to make a difference. And there's a huge split between veterans. I don't want to label people as being pro-war veterans or anti-war veterans, but there is like a split in the middle. And then there's the people who are just hush-hush and don't talk about their experience. And I've had a couple of friends that people that they knew in college didn't even know that they were a veteran for like 3 years of knowing them, you know? And that all goes back to being afraid to tell your story to somebody. But our stories are what matter. You know, this is really what is going to change our future and change our lives for our children and our grandchildren. And every generation to come is, they have to know of our mistakes. you know, just as much as we have to know of our mistakes and where we've made faults in our lives. Because if we keep doing the same over and over again, everyone is still going to be suffering.
We didn't have to go into Iraq. We didn't have to be there. We didn't have to do all the things that we did there. And we did. And one of the reasons that we did is I think that the American public, which is reasonable and averse to war but not opposed to it, was sold a bum bill of goods. If you had said to them, look, we're going to have guys like this, guys like the Lethal Warriors. We're going to have it for decades. It doesn't go away, and we don't really have a good way of treating it. I think people would have given things a second thought. And that's really why I've tried to do what I do, is that if you don't have all the information, you can't make the right decision. And I don't think we did. And I hope next time we do.
We have seen the destruction war brings to all sides. We have struggled to comprehend the horrors of war inflicted through more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, or envision the many years of healing these millions of soldiers and civilians require. The legacy and fallout of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars belong to my generation and those that will come after us. We have grown up watching these wars unfold through events like Abu Ghraib, Haditha, and the Stryker 5 killings. We have seen the million U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan return home to face increased unemployment, high rates of alcohol and drug dependence, mental trauma, and suicide as a result of their experiences in battle. A number of factors contributed to the misconduct and crimes committed by members of the American military, both abroad and upon returning home. Some soldiers should not have been in the military or in conflict zones in the first place, whether due to behavioral issues or underlying mental disorders. What lessons should my generation and future generations of Americans take from Iraq and Afghanistan? To better screen who we put in uniform and train to kill? To properly train and supervise members of the military and maintain high standards for conduct? To better recognize and treat trauma from military service? All of these things, clearly. But the common element in these horrific events is war itself. Fighting better supervised wars with a better screened and better trained military will do little to shield against the horror of war as a traumatic experience. Even as the U.S. welcomes its soldiers home from Iraq and Afghanistan and realizes the damage done to thousands of its own, some of our leaders call for additional wars. So the question remains, have we really learned the cost of war?
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration says Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's high office should shield him from a lawsuit over his role in the killing of a U.S.-based journalist making a turnaround from Joe Biden's passionate campaign trail denunciations of the prince over the brutal slaying. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Responsible Statecraft wrote, the Biden administration has moved to grant Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sovereign immunity for his role in ordering the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul. The government's determination is non-binding and remains to be reviewed by the judge overseeing the lawsuit brought against MBS by Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, and the organization Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAN. However, it represents the latest signal that the Biden administration will not hold MBS accountable for the slaying and dismemberment of a U.S. resident. In September, Saudi Arabia announced that the Crown Prince would take on the role of Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, a post ordinarily held by the King. The decision appears to have been primarily motivated by the pending U.S. lawsuit because, as Prime Minister and thus head of government, MBS is shielded from prosecution. The Crown Prince's new status as Prime Minister arguably grants him sovereign immunity automatically. But the announcement is disappointing in that it reflects a pattern of the U.S. government failing to hold MBS accountable in any way. President Trump actively thwarted congressional efforts to try to punish Saudi Arabia. The global outcry provoked by Khashoggi's brutal murder amplified existing concerns about the U.S. role in supporting the violence and starvation wreaked by the war on Yemen that MBS launched as war minister in 2015. Congress did successfully end mid-air refueling for Saudi and Emirati warplanes dropping bombs on Yemen, but Trump vetoed the Congressional War Powers Resolution that would have ended all U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war. Initially, it seemed that Biden would finally rethink the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Biden had campaigned on making MBS a pariah for his human rights abuses. Yet since taking office, Biden has consistently prioritized continuity in U.S.-Saudi relationship. In February 2021, soon after taking office, the Biden administration declined to hold MBS accountable for Khashoggi's murder, despite releasing the intelligence report that concluded that MBS was indeed responsible. More recently, Biden reversed his stated commitment not to meet with the Crown Prince when he flew to Jeddah in July and fist-bumped the royal in hopes of encouraging the kingdom to pump more oil to offset high prices caused by sanctions on Russia. Instead, OPEC Plus, the oil cartel dominated by Riyadh, announced a production cut of 2 million barrels per day in October. This sparked outrage in Washington, especially among Democrats, who feared for their congressional majorities with midterms looming. Although the administration initially promised consequences for Saudi Arabia, Biden's national security advisor later stated that the relationship would be re-evaluated in a methodical, strategic, effective way. Meanwhile, the initial outrage from Congress appears to have dissipated, especially after the Democrats performed better than expected in the midterms. Is MBS fully rehabilitated? Theoretically, MBS could return to the United States if he chose, whereas previously there remained a question of whether doing so would put him in legal jeopardy. MBS has yet to return to the UK, even missing the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, an event that drew monarchs and crown princes from all other Arab kingdoms. It seems much of the world has decided to overlook MBS' responsibility for the gruesome murder, not to mention his many other human rights abuses. Although the administration's latest move is hardly surprising, it does beg the question, what would it take for Washington to finally rethink its relationship with Riyadh? Also, Guardian wrote, in this regard, the Biden administration has told the U.S. court that Mohammed bin Salman should be granted sovereign immunity in a civil case involving the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, effectively ending the last-ditch attempt to hold the Saudi crown prince legally accountable for the 2018 killing. In a filing released late recently, the Biden administration said the crown prince's recent promotion to the role of prime minister meant that he was sitting head of government and, accordingly, immune from the lawsuit. The United States government has expressed grave concerns regarding Jamal Khashoggi's horrific killing and has raised these concerns publicly and with the most senior levels of the Saudi government. The Department of Justice said in its filing, adding that the U.S. had also imposed financial sanctions and visa restrictions related to the murder. It said, however, the doctrine of head of state immunity is well established in customary international law and has been consistently recognized in long-standing executive branch practice as a status-based determination that does not reflect the judgment on the underlying conduct at issue in the litigation. The government's filing included an attached letter from Richard Visick, acting legal advisor to the U.S. State Department, instructing the Department of Justice to submit a suggestion of immunity to the court. Legal experts say the U.S. government's position, which was filed to a U.S. district court, will likely lead Judge John Bates to dismiss a civil case brought against Prince Mohammed and his accomplices by Hatice Cengiz, the outspoken fiancé of Khashoggi. Dawn, a pro-democracy advocacy group that was founded by the murdered Washington Post columnist, was a co-plaintiff in the case, which said Prince Mohammed and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged, tortured and killed Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Sarah Lee Whitson, Dawn's executive director, issued a scathing rebuke of the administration in the wake of its decision, calling it an unnecessary elective action that will serve only to undermine the most important action for accountability for Khashoggi's heinous murder. It's beyond ironic that Biden has single-handedly assured Mohammed bin Salman can escape accountability when it was President Biden who promised the American people he would do everything to hold him accountable. Not even the Trump administration did this, she said. In June, Bates invited the Biden administration to weigh in on whether it believed Prince Mohammed bin Salman should be granted sovereign immunity in the matter and agreed to give the U.S. government two extensions before demanding that it file its views by September 17th. A legal observer close to the matter said it has always been understood that even though the U.S. government is not a party to the civil claim, its views would be decisive, and that the judge in the matter would very likely proceed with the case or dismiss it, depending on the U.S. government's position. The Biden administration's decision, which in effect will extinguish Cengiz's last hope for justice, will likely be met with intense criticism by Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who have pressed the administration to take a tougher stance against its West Asian partner. One lawyer close to the matter said the decision was disastrous for accountability, for human rights, for impunity. The legal decision also makes clear that U.S. President Joe Biden has fully abandoned the campaign promise to hold Mohammed bin Salman accountable for Khashoggi's murder. It raises questions about Biden's public remarks last month in which he said Saudi Arabia would face consequences for leading an OPEC Plus decision to cut oil production, a move that was seen by the U.S. administration as siding with Russia over the interests of American allies. P People familiar with the matter said the decision was reached after a big debate at the top levels of the White House, with some senior U.S. officials arguing that it would be difficult to defend the Biden administration's claim that human rights are at the center of its foreign policy while simultaneously allowing MBS, as the Crown Prince is known, to skirt accountability for his role in the murder. Cengiz's lawyers have argued that she turned to the U.S. courts for help because no other forum, including her native Turkey, had an independent enough judiciary to freely adjudicate her complaints. Mohammed bin Salman has denied he had personal involvement in the Khashoggi murder. It has been clear since June that the future of the case hinged on the question of whether, in the eyes of the U.S. government, MBS, widely seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was considered a sovereign like a president or king, since in most cases sovereigns are considered immune from U.S. lawsuits. When Biden first entered the White House, he declined to engage with MBS directly. His press secretary argued repeatedly at the time that Prince, though seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was not Biden's counterpart. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies released an unclassified report that said Prince Mohammed bin Salman had likely ordered Khashoggi's murder. The president's stance changed last summer when he visited Jeddah and met with the Crown Prince, giving the heir to the throne a fist bump.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij, Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. And the topic is financial matters and banking and the Islamic laws about them according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. You know that the banks sometimes give you different kinds of loans based on the purpose you want to serve with that money, you know. And one of those, reasons, actually, one would like to go to the banks to ask for the money, to borrow money, or to take loans from the banks is actually to buy, for example, any piece of property or estate. All right?
Yes.
So if we buy some estate, some property, through one of those housing banks, and we agree to pay back the money by monthly installments, of course, and this is usually the case when you take a loan. Is this type of transaction, first of all, valid according to the Shar or Sharia law? And the second question is that do we become the owners of those property even if we haven't finished repayment?
Well, there's no objection to the transaction if the bank have bought the property for itself, because it's common that the bank buys a property with the money that it has and it gives. Now the bank then sells. The bank sells it to a customer, to someone, by installments, in several installments. And this is the case with the banks in almost Muslim and non-Muslim countries. And this time around, we see that banks actually occupy or take a possession of a house, then the same house is sold to someone who is looking for a property, and then of course the bank actually sells that house to the person, and then that person is required to pay the installments, over a period of time. And, mm-hmm. and of course, according to His Eminence, there is no objection to this kind of transaction.
I see. Okay. Another question, Sheikh Javid, is quite related to the housing banks, in fact. Under the title of the partnership or any other deal, you know, that the banks grant some loans to some people or to interested customers, basically, right, for building their own houses. The banks charge also, you know, an increase or an interest varying from 5% to 8%, okay?
Yes.
Well, what's the ruling, what's the Islamic law about this type of loan, especially with the surcharge?
Well, taking the money from the bank under the title of partnership or any other proper and legal transaction cannot be deemed a loan, and it cannot be considered a loan, or it cannot be considered an act of borrowing money.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, in this case, the profits should not be the profit also made by the bank can be halal because it's kind of a partnership, as you rightly mentioned, because it's a kind of partnership or a kind of deal which is basically halal. So if the bank makes any profit and the profit is divided between the bank and the customer, there is no objection to the deal, and the transaction will be allowed. So basically, there is no objection to taking the money under any of these titles, like ju'ala, like musharaka, like you know, mudaraba, which is a very good instrument for conducting halal and allowable transactions. You know, many people do not know anything about these types of let's say titles or transactions, which are available and which can make the transaction very very valid. And they actually these people who are ignorant, they just carry out transactions which are suspected of being unlawful, of being haram, and which is why the whole transaction seems to be kind of riba based, and that's not permissible. So, first of all, I suppose those people who invest money in with the banks or deposit their money with the banks, they should develop a kind of knowledge and understanding of the transactions, and they should go for the transaction which is halal. There are different leeway or escape ways of escaping usury, ways of escaping actually riba, and ways of not falling into riba. So once a person learns these, gets acquainted with these different types of transactions, of course, it will be safer and more prudent for him to opt for one of the transactions which is halal and which is lawful according to Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic is still financial matters and Islamic laws about banking according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, when you live in a non-Islamic country, usually you got a lot of work to do actually when want to buy, for example, a house, so you need to return to or resort to a bank. And normally we don't know the personnel working in the bank, whether they are Muslim or not, okay?
Yes.
So is it permissible for us Muslims to, you know, to receive any interest, basically?
Yes.
Paid on the, you know, any deposit in those banks. And we don't know whether the owners of those banks and the people who are working in the bank are among the people of the book or not, or Muslims or polytheists, for example. Mm-hmm. All right? And is it permissible to have the right of disposal over such sums of money, regardless of, again, whether or not the depositor made it conditional that he be paid the interest?
Well, there is some detail about this question, because first of all, we need to understand that generally speaking, it is always permissible to receive interest from non-Muslims and their banks. So this is a very broad and general answer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the banks can be owned by the people of the book, or by polytheists or pagans or those who do not believe in any deity or God. And of course, it does not make any difference. It makes no difference at all whether they are Christians or Jews or polytheists. So mm-hmm. It is permissible to receive interest from them and from their banks.
But is it permissible to put your money there?
Yeah, it is permissible to put your money, to deposit your money with their banks. And also, it is permissible to place a condition for interest. And of course, placing a condition does not make the interest that you receive haram.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people who are living, some Muslims who live in the West, they are under the impression that in receiving interest from anyone, whether Muslim or non-Muslim, is absolutely forbidden. I think mm-hmm. this is the wrong perception of Islamic law. This is misunderstanding on the part of some Muslims. They should understand, they should note that receiving interest from non-Muslims, whether Christians or the people of the book, Ahli Kitab, or the people who do not believe in any revealed books,
mm-hmm.
is permissible. Even it is permissible to put or place a condition for interest, and the interest you receive from them is halal.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawbit, and thank you for joining us. This program, Islamic Law, on IRIB English Radio. The topic was Islamic laws about financial matters and banking, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.